Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. We're here in the studio today, week into the close down. And I was talking to folks who were going to the Grand Canyon to come all the way out here. And, of course, the Grand Canyon's closed, all the national parks.
Yeah, they gave it credit for, you know, on Facebook, some of my artist friends in Sedona gave credit to the increase in traffic in Sedona to the closing of the Grand Canyon. And I was talking to a famous restaurateur in Cottonwood that we're going to have on the show next week, Eric Jurison.
Why don't we start off today?
And he said the reason his business increased was because he said it's, and he felt, and he explored it in depth, that it was unfortunate. So other people's misfortune turned out to be a little bit of a boon to him. Democratic Perspectives has gotten a band. Do you hear them tuning up now in the background? And we're kind of grateful for it. We're going to talk about foodopoly this morning. It's really an incredibly popular topic. And it's exactly what it sounds like, foodopoly. And what you heard was the author calling in. We're getting ready to talk to Winona Hodder, who wrote this incredibly disturbing book called Foodopoly. You know, the reviewers gave her they called her meticulous, and I think that's a good thing, especially the older I get. I like the research. I like to see meticulousness. But they made it sound maybe not so good. But regardless of her meticulousness, there is something on every page that you want to stick your head up and read to your partner across the breakfast table or send in an email to people who really don't want to hear from you. But there's just all sorts of interesting and terrible and frightening facts here in her book called Foodopoly. She sponsors a website and a Facebook page called Food and Water Watch. It's also one of those things that you're glad there's people in the world that do this, that watch our food, watch our water, see what's going in it. And see what's happening. The upshot is that the family, and her book is dedicated to the family farmer. The three S: family farms fighting for justice. It kind of seems wrong that a family farm would have to fight for justice. It kind of seems like they should just fight. Having done a little farming, they should just have to fight the weather. Believe me, it's bad enough. Anybody that's ever tried to grow anything knows fighting the weather is bad enough. But Winona's book, Foodopoly, talks about fighting for justice, for the family farmer against, as we can imagine, the corporate farm, industry, and, how powerful it's been. In keeping us from getting the food that we want.
My parents one time took me out to the family farm in western Oklahoma, but they didn't even own the family farm. They were tenant farmers.
Right.
And if you looked at the land, it looked impossible to raise anything at all. And the whole area had been abandoned and replaced by large corporate farms raising winter wheat, an irrigation that wasn't available in the 30s, when my relatives suffered so much. I grew up in cattle country and spent my life listening to ranchers complain about the price of beef and the control of the market by giant corporations. And it's only gotten worse, folks.
It's one of the things that she talks about, and we're going to talk to her here in a minute, right? And fewer than 40 states have bottled water regulations. I mean, you can take anything, stick it in a bottle, and call it healthy water. And some states that do have regulations, they're much weaker than the limited federal standards. For 30 to 40% of bottled water, the FDA does not regulate. And I don't know about you, but when it's so convenient. I buy bottled water for convenience, and I feel bad about the plastic and all this other good stuff. But I say, well, you know, okay, I can recycle the plastic, and I can have the water, you know, and I need the water, so I buy it. I buy the bottled water. For 30% to 40%, they require no testing, no bacterial contamination. It's a little scary. Looking for physical contaminants, Nestle has been the target of the ire. We got our author.
Yes, this morning we have Winona Halter, and she's executive director of Food and Water Watch. And it's one of the most highly rated charities by these charity rating organizations. She's written a book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about Winona. She's executive director of the Food and Water Watch. As Steve just said. And
are you there, Winona?
I am here.
Oh,
I'm
great!
So pleased
we're so glad to be with you this morning. Yes, we're so good. We're so glad to hear from you. Mike's been talking about your book a little bit, and we've both been reading it on Kindle, which takes out all the beautiful, very informative color diagrams and stuff. And
well, we did say that you dedicated the book to the family farmer. And I was talking a little bit before you came on about family farms, and you said family farmers fighting for justice, and it seems like, having done a little farming, farming is fighting weather mostly, and now they have to fight for justice too.
Well, you know, it's true. There is a lot of fighting of the elements, and it's very difficult, especially today when we have a lot of erratic weather. But, you know, it's very hard for farmers to actually make a living every year because farm policy has been directed at benefiting the biggest users of farm products, and those are the food processing companies. And we have 20 food processing companies that control about 60% of the brands in the grocery store. And they want really, really cheap farm products. And so a lot of our federal policies for farmers over the last 40 years have been weakened, and they now benefit these very large companies at the expense of farmers. You know, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's own statistics, a mid-sized farmer makes about $19,300 take-home pay every year.
Jeez, what's up with that?
Yeah, well, that's a real problem, isn't it? So I wrote Foodopoly because I really wanted to go out and talk about the effect that the food system is having, both on farmers and consumers, for that matter. You know, I think consumers don't necessarily get the foods that are the best for them because of all of the advertising. And the deck is kind of stacked because of these federal policies.
And isn't it the whole industry is now organized in a hierarchical way, right? And so I think you say in your book, something you alluded to earlier, that, and if, you know, the top realtors of food control 50% of the market.
That's
poultry,
right.
58%, hogs, 66%.
And let's talk about
beef,
beer. 80. Beer.
Yeah,
two companies control all the beer.
Companies that own 80% of brands in this country. Most people don't know that.
Let me say that again. Two companies own 80% of the beer.
Yeah, and it's going to be increasingly hard for microbreweries to get their product into stores because there's such a control over the distribution system by these large foreign companies. They're not even American-owned companies.
My son stood in my living room yesterday and told me that he's starting a brewery down in the Capitol with some with some friends, and dad is, I'm proud because he's, you know, he's selling selling an illegal substance, I guess I'm proud of, and so on. But I'll have to do a follow-up phone call.
Breweries, if they're connected to a restaurant and the consumer actually comes in and buys the beer at the restaurant, some of those breweries can actually make a living, although even for restaurateurs, it's becoming more difficult to have access to affordable food products for their business.
Well, that's good, because that's exactly...
But it's when the microbrewery wants to get their product into the local grocery store that the real trouble begins.
Well, that's good, because that's exactly what he's talking about. I want to... can you tell us the two beer companies? I went to the Facebook page, and it was kind of a wonderful video, but it was a little bit of a guessing game. I had to go someplace else to find the two companies. Do we know the two beer companies?
Yeah, it's Anheuser-Busch, which is Belgium-owned, used to be an American company, and SAB, South African Breweries, which is actually UK-owned. And these two companies, Anheuser-Busch, the Belgian company, is the largest. And they've been on a buying spree for the last 20 years.
So my Bud Light, it's not mine, by the way, but Bud Light comes from Belgium. Or at least the money goes to Belgium.
The money goes to Belgium. I mean, I think that's what people don't think about. They don't realize that when this consolidation happens, all of that profit ends up in some city far away.
Let me ask you, because I don't think most people know much about farm policy and how we came to this. Can you give us a quick portrait? And your book's about 300 pages, so I know we're asking a lot. But give us a quick portrait of what the food industry actually looks like. Because when we hear the rhetoric, it's all about family farmers and so forth and so on. But what is the food industry like? How is it organized?
Well, let me say that we did have farm policy that worked for farmers in the 1930s and 40s during the New Deal. But those policies were chipped away, and it became very dramatic, the chipping away in the 1970s, when the Secretary of Agriculture began to use that position to really stop the programs that made it possible for farmers to make the cost of production, and farmers were encouraged to get very, very large and to overproduce. And over the next 30 years, those policies from the 1940s that kept overproduction from happening, I'm talking about things like a grain reserve and policies that allowed farmers to actually not put in too many crops. It's called supply management. Those policies were deregulated. And then in the 1980s, under the Reagan administration, we saw our antitrust laws basically eviscerated and narrowed. And those are the laws that kept companies from getting too big. And so what happened is that companies began this flurry of mergers and acquisitions that have lasted all the way up into today, and especially in the food industry, but this happened in every industry. And so what happens when companies get very, very, very large? They get much wealthier, right? And that's during the period that we began to see companies, corporations, have enormous influence over elections and federal policy. And, you know, I would say it was really the beginning of the creation of legalized bribery for our political system. And these companies had a lot of influence over the trade negotiations that were taking place under the Clinton administration in the mid-1990s.
NAFTA.
Yeah, with NAFTA. So what Ronald Reagan began with the evisceration of antitrust laws, I always say Bill Clinton finished, because he did, his administration did a very poor job of antitrust enforcement, and we began to see lots of these companies, especially the meat packers, the grocery industry, get much, much larger, and they actually had an influence over trade policy. In fact, Cargill, the giant grain trader, put together a 100-company coalition that wrote the trade policies that relate to food. And then our farm policy was completely deregulated to get in line with trade policy. And that means that today, 50% of our fruits, more than 20% of our vegetables are produced overseas. We have companies like Walmart that have become enormously powerful in the area of groceries. They control 50% overall, but in many communities they have 70 to 90% of the market. One out of three grocery dollars goes to Walmart. Wow. And they're a company that has so much power over the food system that they figured out how to suck the profit from the ground all the way up into their coffers, so that the Walmart heirs have as much wealth as the bottom 40% of Americans. And, you know, this kind of Walmartization of our food system means that that even the very largest growers have a lot of trouble making a profit. And so we've had to see consolidation even at the farm level.
So the farmers,
I guess that's the 5-minute version of what's happened to farm policy.
So there was a deliberate policy, which you trace in the first few chapters of your book, to get small farmers off the farm. I think most people listening think that it was pure economics that got small farmers off, and that did play a role, but you have a portrait is very much just like what's happening now of an organization, and they're very open about getting small farmers off the farm.
That's right. It was a policy of depopulating rural areas and moving young men into urban areas, especially in the north, to be cheap labor in factories. And it was federal policy, and that over a course of a number of decades completely changed farming, and I would say our society as well.
The social engineering that the conservatives hammer the liberals for doing all the time, but this case was done by liberals. We are talking to Winona Hodder. Her book is Foodopoly. We've been looking at it extensively, certainly Stephen and I, the last couple of days, and it's frightening. I was mentioning before you came on about how your exhaustive research and how there's something on every page, Winona, that makes me want to, almost every page, of course, it makes me want to, you know, put my head up and read it to someone or highlight it and send it out as an email and if I'm going to be scared, I want my friends to be scared also. But I'm enjoying the book immensely. Now you're going on. Let's take a little break from the book for a second. You gave that wonderful synopsis and the summary of going from family farms to corporate farms and the dangers therein. But where's Winona? Winona's got to be on her hobby horse here in the month of October and November. You'll be all over.
Yeah, that's right. I'm traveling extensively with Foodopoly because, you know, I really wrote it to be a call to action that we need people to go beyond voting with their fork. It's great to, you know, to be part of the local food movement and to feed yourself well, but we need real political action. And I think we can all see with the current shutdown of our federal government and the refusal by Boehner to allow a vote in Congress over the budget, why we need people to get re-engaged in politics. So I've been traveling with Foodopoly since January, and this next week I'm going to be in North Carolina and Kentucky, and then I'll be back out to the West Coast to the Seattle area. And, you know, every place I go, I see that people are fighting mad, and they do want to take back our democracy. And, you know, I think that what's happened to our food system really needs to be a call to action, especially to young people, to get involved in politics.
I know it has been for some of my local food people, the farmers, the fruit farmers in Oak Creek Canyon, have educated me on some of this stuff.
I don't know whether we want to address it, but one of your charts shows that even organic food processing is controlled by a very small group of
yes.
companies, and all these wonderful name products that we go out and buy are owned by the same kind of corporations, a little bit smaller than control the rest of the food industry.
Yeah, you know, it's really sad, and, you know, I've been involved in organic agriculture really for three decades, and, you know, we had this vision of organic food both being healthy for the soil, healthy for people, and healthy for rural economies. But what's happened because of the consolidation is there's 20 giant food processing companies. 14 of them own the largest organic brands. So, you know, companies like General Mills and Kellogg's and Kraft and ConAgra and Coca-Cola, Pepsi. These companies own brands that were, in most cases, at one time independent organic brands, and they gobbled them up. And it's unfortunate that the way our economic system is organized today, that this is what happens. And in large part, it's because it's very difficult for small farmers to have access to the market, for small manufacturers to have access to the market. And so we now see, look at, for instance, organic greens or greens generally. We have two counties in the country that produce most of the greens during one season of the year, and then another couple of counties in another part of the country that produce greens during the rest of the year.
Wow.
Now, this is kind of crazy, especially greens, which could be grown anywhere in the country
be a
way for organic agriculture to begin taking off locally. But there's no way that somebody growing greens can get into the market.
Yeah, year long, too. It's amazing. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I cut you off.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, it also affects the quality of these organic products, because what we have is these large companies lobbying to weaken the organic standards, because they don't care about organics as more sustainable food, better for the environment, better for people. They see it as a niche market where a product that can be sold for more profit at a higher price. So I think that that's one of the things that should inspire people who care about organic food to get involved in the politics of this.
Exactly. For me, it was milk. A man in my age group probably shouldn't be drinking cow's milk, but I love it. And to find out my favorite and there is definitely, folks, if you're a milk drinker, there's definitely a huge difference between organic milk and factory milk. And of course, some of my milk that I've been buying is the Horizon product is factory milk and owned by Jimmy Dean and so that was a discovery for me. But greens is somehow sacrilegious. If I'm buying blueberries and it's December in the United States, can I pretty much guarantee that those blueberries are coming from Chile?
Yeah, you're going to be getting those blueberries from someplace else. But, you know, it's not just the seasonality. What I learned in writing Foodopoly is that to be in the business of being a shipper packer of fruits and vegetables, you have to be a giant company, and you have to have an international arm, either a contractual relationship or ownership relationship. And those large shipper packers that are distributing fruits and vegetables to the largest grocery players, they are looking for the cheapest price. And sometimes that has something to do with seasonality, but sometimes it's just because there's a lower price. You know, I was really shocked to learn in doing my research that processed fruits and vegetables, China's become about the third largest player. So if you're going into a Whole Foods, which is a large consolidated grocery chain as well, and you're buying frozen edamame, say, there's a very good chance that that's coming from China. All of those frozen and canned foods tend to be processed in other countries.
So the control of the food market by these giant corporations means that the farmer gets a smaller piece of the pie, the people who are actually raising the food, right?
That's right. They get a smaller piece of the pie, and they can only be at all profitable if they have very, 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 very large acreage. And that's true whether you're a grain farmer or you're growing peaches. You know,
so if they
control a lot of acreage.
If they control the way the products are distributed and they control the stores that they're sold in, or they have these relationships, and you have elaborate charts of corporate relationships, then they can control how the money and all the profits are distributed from this, and also the nature of the products being produced, right? The kinds of...
Yes, that's right. They have enormous power. Well, let's look at Walmart. Walmart has enormous power even over a company like Pepsi, which is the largest food company in the United States, although mostly they produce junk food, snack foods. But they, for Pepsi, Walmart is such a big customer that they do whatever Walmart says, while Walmart has more choices about where to get its products. And that's how the grocery industry really has so much control over the food system. They can put all of this pressure on the suppliers to cut costs and to change ingredients, to change packaging. They have enormous say over what happens.
Walmart behaves the same in many industries, and it's obscene. I mean, they don't have what I consider their customer best interest at heart. Can we talk about meat? We've been talking about produce pretty much so far the whole show. Let's talk about meat for a minute. You have before I want to talk about successes. I go to your Facebook page. You talk about some of the successes Food and Water Watch has had. Let's talk about meat next.
Okay. Well, meat is the production of meat is very consolidated because of the consolidation in the industry, and there are such a few meat packers, companies like Tyson, that they are able to get these products very cheaply, and farmers don't have any place to sell their product to.
Tyson's
the
number four on your list.
Because there's no market for the animals. And so what we've seen happen is that a company like Tyson, which is one of the largest two meat companies in the world.
Yeah, number four on your list.
Yeah, they are able, right, number four on the food processors, but in the area of meat, Tyson and JBS kind of flip places depending on who they bought most recently. So the Brazilian company JBS that owns brands like Swift and Tyson. So they have control over these livestock growers, and the livestock growers can now grow many more animals in a confined feeding operation because feed is cheap because of the overproduction of feed. And this consolidation also means that Tyson has a lot of power over the political system, and they have recently been able to lobby to allow poultry to be slaughtered at 175 birds per minute. That's per minute. And so chemical washes are used to kill the bacteria, things like chlorine and trisodium phosphate. Meanwhile, the contract grower who actually has the chicken warehouse with 100,000 to 300,000 birds in it, they make on average $12,000 to $15,000 a year. And I think that pretty well sums up the state of our meat production.
Yeah.
Is that Tyson gets all the profit, and the contract grower gets the waste and the debt for the facility.
And you're talking here about a large contract grower, right? And even a large contract grower is at its extreme disadvantage in dealing with these giant corporations who then control, you know, where the food goes and what it costs.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, these growers, like poultry growers, a lot of them, they're often afraid to speak out because they're in enormous debt for these facilities. And it's often kind of a last-ditch effort to save the family farm. We're talking about very rural areas like Alabama or the eastern shore of Virginia and Maryland. And they're made big promises. U.S. Department of Agriculture will often guarantee the loans. So they take on this enormous debt. If they criticize the company doesn't bring them any more birds, and then they lose their farm. So, you know, we see a lot of abuse of the animals, of the waterways where all the waste is dumped into, and of the contract growers. I mean, the abuse goes all the way up and down the system. And the consumer who eats this very marginal product.
Let me read some of the companies real quickly. We're talking about Pepsi, Pepsi, Nestle's, Kraft, Jimmy Dean, Tyson, JB's, Smithfield, Hormel, Kellogg's, Cargill, Sara Lee, Coca-Cola. Now, these are the organic companies. That was non-organic. Now we're going to read a short list of organic companies, like Organic Valley, the Safeway brand, Jimmy Dean, the Hain Group, Earthbound Farms, Pacific Natural Foods, Cascadian Farms, and Clif Bar. So these are some of the organic products that some of us bought with a little more satisfaction than the others. But we're talking that that's not true.
So I suppose we should ask.
Well, you know, General Mills picked up Muir Glen, Cascadian Farms, Larabar, and some others, and Kellogg's picked up Morningstar and Cashy and a number of other brands. So, you know, these big companies picked up the organic brands because they saw them as being very, very profitable brands. So, you know, but I do want to say that really on top of this dysfunctional food system, that the players that really pull the strings beyond the Walmarts are the financial services industry, because all of the pressure is to have high quarterly profits to make the stock price go up, and the deregulation that took place in the food industry in the mid-1990s. Also, we saw the financial services industry deregulated. And I think to right a lot of the wrongs that we see going on in our society around food, but also a lot of the other abuses, we're going to have a re-regulation of this financial services industry that's really focused on profitability for the wealthiest among us, and is putting pressure to cheapen and destroy all of the products that we eat. And, you know, I would say it has a lot to do with why we have an economy that the rich are getting richer and everyone else is getting poorer, and we don't see the job growth that we should have. It's all of these same policies that have led to the situation that we're in today.
So it looks like we have all these brands. It looks like we have all this diversity, but it's actually a top-down controlled system. The pricing, the rules, what you produce, what kind of chickens you produce for them. Everything is coming top down. It's part of the larger problem of domination of so much of the society and economics by a few companies. Now, they would argue that there's no way of avoiding that, right? The consolidation of farms, consolidation of food companies is inevitable in a modern world. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that it's not inevitable. It's a result of policy decisions that began in the 1980s when the Reagan administration came into office and decided to basically undo the regulatory framework that meant that we had antitrust regulation, and that for the decades before the Reagan administration, both political parties agreed that we needed strong antitrust laws, that we had an economic system that was built on competition. And when the Reagan administration came into office, they cut the budgets, they got rid of whole departments, and most importantly, they narrowed the definition of what an antitrust violation is. And since that time, we've had poor enforcement in all administrations, Republican and Democratic, and there has been a decision at the public policy level to allow monopolization. And it's not efficient for most people. And the whole excuse that this is efficiency, we have to ask, efficient for whom?
Yeah, exactly. Give us a little hope, Winona. On your Foodopoly book, give us a little hope. You had some successes. You got some of the arsenic out of
last week, a collective success. After years of campaigning to get arsenic out of chicken feed,
feed? I don't think most people know that, Winona.
Agreed that we should not have arsenic in chicken feed, and made a rule that affects some of those pharmaceutical brands. I mean, this is, you know, it's a nuts and bolts battle that we're in. And, you know, I think we can't lose hope. I think we have to have the long vision. I mean, look at how many years it took for the civil rights movement to make progress. Look at how many years it took to get the 8-hour workday. That was 100 years of organizing. How many years it took to get child labor out of factories in the United States.
You know, women to vote.
We are in a dark period, but what we need to do is, rather than telling people that there's nothing that can be done, we need to urge everybody to get involved in the politics of their community and their state, and that's what we're going to need to do to change
our federal politics. Tell us about Prop 522. Tell us about Prop 522 in Oregon.
That is an initiative that will require labeling of genetically engineered food. And we've seen a surge of interest in labeling genetically engineered food ever since last November, when Monsanto and the processed food industry spent $50 million to defeat an initiative in California. People were so mad that organizing took off, and in 30 states around the country, I mean, states like Iowa, New Mexico, Illinois, we saw legislation introduced to label genetically engineered food. Now, this is a long-term battle, and the next place that this is really happening is in Washington State, and we think we have a really good chance of winning there. Was legislation that was passed in Connecticut, and I think that the feds recognize that there's a big movement in this country to label genetically engineered food, and that we're going to see action on this.
More important, it was local, or as important, I should say. It was it came up from local organizations to control the ridiculous nationwide laws. We understand.
We'd like to thank Winona Howder for joining. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, that's fine.
Who's executive director of Food and Water Watch. And she's gotten a book that's gotten tremendously good reviews. And
right.
She's traveling around the country. It's called Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America.
Very readable. Quite readable. Like they say, they call it a tour de force, which is a compliment, and then the meticulous research, I think, is a plus also.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. And if people want to learn more, they can go to our website, foodandwaterwatch.org.
Absolutely. There's lots of those.
Okay, Winona, thank you very much for joining us on Democratic Perspective.
Bye-bye.
All right. We got a couple of announcements as we kind of close here. We want to talk about our picnic coming up. Before I do that, one of the ways you can find out about our picnic is on the internet.
Not finally.
We want to praise this.
They
this
are
is
in
great.
The avant-garde.
And
of
the
avant-garde. Live.
Oh, it's live on the internet on chasmradio.com. So please go to chasmradio.com. Those of you who can't find, I've a number of friends who don't even own a radio anymore.
No, don't talk about that, Mike.
They don't own a radio anymore. I mean,
what's the URL to
chasm.com. Chasm Radio, excuse me.
Chasmradio.com.
Chasmradio, they'll spell it out. KAZMRADIO.com. And you can hear...
So if you don't want to listen to it on AM, you can get it streamed live. And you can also get it as podcast to listen whenever you want to by going to our website.
VVID.org. Yeah, you can hear VVID.org, and you can play it on your whatever player you have on your hard drive.
But we do have some announcement as Mike started to talk
Try
about
to get here. To the picnic here. Yeah. The Dove Door Picnic. This is our annual thing. October 13th, a week away, 11:30, up at the Living Springs sort of resort. It shares the same driveway with Trout Farm up in Oak Creek Canyon, just a few miles up the canyon. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful spot in Oak Creek Canyon, just down by the water. Rustic cabins, and what we do there is I'll be doing the cooking.
Mike will be grilling the burgers and hot dogs.
Nothing fancy, that's for sure. I'm making some beans and chili. We're exchanging emails last night on all of that. We have some great speakers. Representative Ann Kirkpatrick will be back to town. She comes to Sedona as often as she can.
She may not be able to speak, Mike, because of the crisis in Washington. We're still waiting to see on her, but she's certainly scheduled to speak. We hope that we'll have an extensive period of being able to talk with her. The picnic is a lot of fun, folks. The speeches are short, and the food is long. There's cakes.
We might hurt on the politicians, and we give them 3 minutes, 5 minutes maybe. There's lots of homegrown food. It is a fundraiser. We do have a little auction. We've got some great wine. We have some donated beer. It's as picnicky as you imagine any picnic could be in a beautiful, beautiful spot. There is very limited parking, so please, if you can carpool, please do that. But we do charge $5 admission.
Yeah, and that covers lunch, folks, and wonderful salads and stuff that people have made. Then Door has on October 17th, that's Thursday, we have our monthly breakfast, and it's about restorative justice, and we have Warren Sanford and Elizabeth Yancey. Elizabeth was the magistrate here in Sedona for a long time, and Warren is Justice of the Peace pro tem, and he's running for Justice of Peace up in Coconino County. And they have had a lot of hands-on experience with restorative justice. I must admit, I don't know much about it. It's a good chance to get into a dialogue with people who have a different take on justice, but who've also, have worked not theoretically, but really on the ground with restorative justice. It's a really interesting program.
It's not a typically liberal thing.
Not necessarily, yeah. No. So
I like that we're doing it.
It can be conservative. It's not a liberal or conservative thing. There's supporters on both. In fact, when I say restorative justice, people say, well, that's not a liberal thing. That's all right.
That's all right.
Let's hear them out and find out about restorative justice. Mike.
The house I live in, the free movie, Doors Free Movie, this month, October 30th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Sedona Library. Free movies, 6 to 8, Sedona Library, October 30th. We're in the criminal justice system. Going from the inmate to the federal judge, a penetrating look inside America's criminal justice system. I'd rather we were talking about the billions of bees that were dying or the millions of bats that were dying, but we're going to talk about crime because it's what everybody wants to talk about. We like talking about crime.
Thank you for being with us today, folks.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.